So let's move to India now. And I just want to say that even though I work for the CDC, the opinions in this report are mine alone and do not represent official policy for the CDC. And of course, I don't work for a corporate hospital in India. I don't treat diarrheal disease or infectious disease in India, so I have no financial relationships to disclose. I first began thinking about climate change and infectious disease when I was working with the CNN team in New Orleans, just immediately after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina. And it turned out that there was a public health official who had lived in New Orleans and was basically from New Orleans for a long time and who came back after Katrina because she was devastated by the fact that New Orleans had become flooded, and when it was evacuated, that it had gone from a fully functioning democracy to near anarchy in a matter of days. And so she was so concerned that she came back to New Orleans, and the municipal water systems had shut down. And she developed diarrhea. So I had to go and treat her for this diarrhea. And that made me begin thinking that if New Orleans water systems can go down, and somebody who's been a long-term resident of New Orleans can develop diarrhea, what about India? India's a hotbed of infectious disease. And I'm a living example of that. I've had malaria, I've had typhoid, I've had gastrointestinal illness, all from visits to the country, unavoidable. So because tropical countries are, of course, much more susceptible to the problems of climate change, it made me start thinking as to what's going to be the effects in this particular country. And of course, we all know what the greenhouse effect is. With human activities, there's going to be enhanced greenhouse effects in all over the world. I wanted to bring to your attention the headline statements of the IPCC report 2013. So that's very new. It just came out in September this year. And the IPCC is, of course, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And now the statements are that the warming of the climate system is unequivocal. Many of the observed changes are unprecedented over decades to millennia. And, of course, the atmosphere and ocean have warmed, the amounts of snow and ice have diminished, sea level has risen, etc., etc. Human influence on the climate system is very clear at this point in time. Yeah. To contrast the IPCC graph on the left, which is from 2001, where it shows the carbon dioxide rise, which is projected by 2010 to go up above 375 parts per million. Now, over half a million years, the levels have fluctuated between 144 to 250 parts per million, and now they're going up above 375 parts per million. Likewise, you see that the latest graph on the right, which is from the 2013 report, that's just 2 months ago, projects the temperature rise in South Asia. And this is, you know, what has got us really worried, that this temperature rise by over the next few decades, what is it going to do to infectious disease and all the vectors that go with it? So what's going on in India? Rain and floods. This has been the history of India. Rain and floods. India lives on the monsoon, lives and dies by the monsoon. The monsoon works, India does well. You get good agricultural output. The monsoon fails, farmers go bankrupt, they commit suicide by actually drinking the pesticides that they're supposed to be using for the crops. And so they live and die by the monsoon. And the monsoon, when it comes, is not like the rains that you see here. It produces floods. And what do these floods do? They produce diarrheal disease, respiratory infections, rodent-borne and other infectious diseases. And of course, the rising sea surface temperatures, as well as the height of the sea levels, these increase tropical cyclone intensity. Not necessarily the frequency of cyclones or hurricanes, as you call them here, but it increases the intensity of the cyclone. And the height of the storm surges, all these lead to loss of clean water, hygiene, and as well as sanitation. So the most recent example, last month, Cyclone Filene. This came in as a Category 4 cyclone, unheard of around the Indian coast. And when it came in, of course, the intensity decreased. But what did it do? Tremendous amounts of flooding, as you can see on the right side. And fortunately, the government, now there was a cyclone warning system. So the government was able to evacuate millions of people off the east coast of India. And so in the end, you had only about 25 deaths, you know, from the cyclone. But you now have the after effects of the cyclone. And the fact is that, you know, many of these houses have been sort of demolished. People don't have places to live. They are now living in refugee camps. And as I said, it's the flooding that is the main problem here. So infectious disease etiology is complex and it's multifactorial. There are many, many factors involved here. Social demographic factors, population growth, etc., urbanization, deforestation, land use change, all of these things have been happening in India, deforestation particularly. Microbes tend to adapt. International travel occurs. People bring microbes from elsewhere to all other countries. For example, dengue has now been found in Florida because of the people migrating from elsewhere who've got dengue, and then the Aedes aegypti sort of spreads the dengue. Temperature, rainfall, humidity, all of these factors are involved. Again, to contrast the viewpoints of the IPCC in 2001 and in 2007, in 2001, IPCC said there's little evidence that climate change has played a significant role in recent resurgence on infectious disease outbreaks. By 2007, the view had already changed. Now it says it has already altered the distribution of some disease vectors, including cholera, possibly malaria, and of course Ross River virus disease, which is an epidemic polyarthritis which is found in Australia, for example. Yeah. Let's talk about malaria. This is a very complex and multifactorial disease, causes a million deaths per year, and you have 400 to 500 million cases that occur on an annual basis. There's global resurgence because of insecticide resistance, human population growth and movement, land use changes that seem to occur, and of course a breakdown in public health infrastructure. Take for example what happened with that cyclone. It breaks down all kinds of public health infrastructures, and people don't have access to the local clinics, the dispensaries, etc. They live in refugee camps, and guess what? The diseases are spreading rapidly out there. Yeah. What happens with malaria and temperature change? Interesting phenomenon here. So both the mosquito and the Plasmodium parasite are very susceptible to temperature change. So at their physiological tolerance limits, what happens is that very small temperature changes can actually kill the parasite. So transmission of malaria is decreased. However, at lower temperatures, even a small temperature increase can actually increase the transmission. So it's going to be mixed effects. So where you have very hot temperatures, you're not going to see much transmission. Whereas at lower temperatures, the transmission might actually increase. And again, deforestation elevates the local temperatures. This we know. And as well as vegetation clearance and irrigation allows formation of open pools. And this increases the transmission. And we see this all the time in India. If you travel within India, you'll see the formation of open pools, particularly after the monsoons. Yeah. And of course, a change in housing type, it also alters the indoor temperatures. This is where the mosquitoes are actually resting after feeding. And so the temperature increase in the house actually increases the number of mosquitoes, the mosquito density in the houses. Yeah. To talk about highland malaria, we just shift continents a little bit, go back to Africa. And the fact is that highland malaria is the malaria that occurs at the altitudinal limit of about 1,500 to 2,000 meters. Above this, the mosquitoes don't spread. And that's why the people living above these altitudes don't actually have never experienced malaria. But now what's happening is that as the temperature seems to rise, the mosquitoes are also rising. So they are impacting the populations which actually live in these higher altitudes. And because these populations in the higher altitudes have no immunity against malaria, they are the ones who are going to be very badly impacted by malaria. So malaria induces a certain low-level immunity in people who live in endemic areas. So for example, I've lived in India, let's say, for 30 years, and I developed a low-level immunity. I came away from India to the United States. I lost that immunity, and I went back to India, and I got a very severe attack of malaria because of the fact that I had lost my low-level immunity while I was living in India. So this low-level immunity disappears in also these people who live above this altitude. And that's the same thing that's going to be happening in India too. You're going to get the malaria occurring in the populations which live above that altitudinal limit. And they're going to get impacted by malaria much worse than what would have happened otherwise. As I said, it's a complex and multifactorial disease. There's no simple model of disease prediction. And the role of climate change in malaria transmission can only be determined by the fact that you need these disease surveillance system that combines a trend analysis of malaria from multiple sites to account for local factors. And as they say, think global, act local. Malaria is a very, very local disease because of all the local differences that exist from region to region and even area to area within the country. I was listening to another climate change session this morning, and they were talking about how useful remote sensing is going to be in predicting the land surface temperatures, which actually correlate very well with the prevalence of the larvae and the pupae of mosquitoes in this area. So a disease surveillance system, which can then correlate with the remote sensing, which tells you what the land surface temperatures are, these kinds of models have to be developed for malaria prediction. And this is the way we're going to actually study malaria in this. As I said, climate change has got very mixed effects on malaria. In some geographical regions, it will actually expand. In other regions, it will contract. Transmission window, for example, is likely to widen in northern and western states and shorten in certain southern states. And it may expand to higher altitudes because the decrease where the temperatures are actually higher within the country. All of this is again going to create problems because of the fact that immunity levels will vary. So, for example, where malaria has been endemic, if the transmission window decreases and then it comes back to that area, people will be impacted even more. So malaria is a complex disease, and unfortunately it's not going to be very easy to understand. But the only way to understand it is to develop these prediction models in which you have a number of different variables that you can input into that model to be able to understand it. Yeah. Let's move to cholera. Fine. Okay. Cholera is a slightly simpler disease to understand. It's been around for a long time. It was recognized in the Charaka Samhita, which is a treatise on Ayurvedic medicine. And previously it was believed to have only a human reservoir. But in the 2000s, molecular techniques showed that the cholera organism actually is naturally occurring in the aquatic environment. So what does that do? Now it means that bacterial populations are associated with plankton blooms. And where the sea surface temperatures go up and the sea surface levels go up, that is going to come into contact with the human populations. And that's how you're going to get outbreaks of cholera. And they've already noticed this off the coast of Latin America as well as Bangladesh. And you have seasonal outbreaks associated with the rise and fall of sea surface height and temperature. So it's a very clear correlation that's going on here. So, and again, you see in those graphs that the correlation between the sea surface height and temperatures and the outbreaks of cholera. So, okay, so what do we do with all this information? I mean, what can clinicians actually expect? So clinicians know, or they should expect, that there's going to be increased illness and death from severe heat waves and storms, cyclones, floods, etc. Okay. There's going to be a change in the range, distribution, and incidence of vector-borne disease outbreaks, particularly dengue and chikungunya, which are very much associated with the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And these epidemics have been occurring in India since the 2500s. I mean, every second family that I visited on trips to India had episodes of either dengue or chikungunya. And both of these are extremely disabling conditions. Yeah. Rural and remote communities, of course, more affected because of access to healthcare, and of course, environmental refugees from the floods, as you saw previously. Yeah. That's a picture of the Bombay floods on the left, and the environmental refugees on the right side. What can physicians do? Can they discuss climate change with patients? No, certainly not. You know, somebody who's sick, you can't start talking to them about climate change. The discussion has to be indirect. You have to start talking about the co-benefits that you get from having a healthy diet, eating more plant foods to reduce the risk of obesity, diabetes, hypertension, etc., etc. There's a huge epidemic of diabetes in India. And here's where the clinicians can make a big difference. You start talking about all these co-benefits to eat plant foods, etc., reduce meat in your diet. And of course, you know, the healthy exercise, walking and biking more, public transportation, etc. You'll find that the urban areas in India are hugely impacted by the fact of the number of automobiles that you have. Air pollution has increased, and public transportation is even though it is used, the middle class have quickly gotten on to the private vehicle bandwagon. Yeah. So, an example of what a big hospital in Mumbai did. They actually instituted many energy-saving measures, and they turned off office equipment, etc., used natural light in corridors, plugged leaks in air conditioning, and they actually saved $90,000 in a couple of years. And if all the hospitals in India were to do this, imagine the amount of savings as well as the reduction in the CO2 emissions in this country. So, I always think about human beings as frogs in warm water. You put frogs in boiling water and you put them in normal water and you start increasing the temperature and the frogs will continue to stay there. If you put them in boiling water, they would jump out. But if you put them in normal water and you keep increasing the temperature slowly, they will stay in there and they'll get cooked. And that's an example of what's happening to us. We're gradually getting acclimatized to these increasing temperatures. Yeah. The IPCC health effects report is the 2014 report is expected next year. Stay tuned. We are very interested in what infectious disease opinions that they have. But in the meantime, we don't stop our work on climate change and infectious disease. Thank you very much.